Welcome to If Then, the show about how technology is changing our lives and our future. I'm April Glazer.
And I'm Will Arunas. Hey, everyone. Welcome to If Then. We're coming to you from Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. We're recording this on the afternoon of Tuesday, November 27th. April is back in town, and we are ready to dig into the tech news of the week.
Yes, I was gone for a couple weeks reporting in Northern California and traveling, but it's good to be back at the mic. And now we're going to talk about something that happened the night before Thanksgiving last week. As Americans were flying in to see family and finalizing their holiday plans, Facebook decided to dump some very serious news. The company admitted that they had indeed asked a conservative PR firm to attack Facebook's nonprofit critics by highlighting their funding ties to the liberal financier George Soros. Facebook leaders had previously denied responsibility for that particular detail, which is understood to be a dog whistle for a common right-wing trope that a cabal of Jewish elites are controlling global affairs. This, to be clear, is anti-Semitic and untrue. And this all comes against a backdrop of increasing tension between top tech companies and their employees. Across Silicon Valley, from Facebook to Amazon to Google to Microsoft, we're seeing workers at these companies organize and demand more ethical practices from their employers.
We'll also talk about the startling news over the weekend that the first gene-edited babies were reportedly born in China as part of a secret project at a university. Using the gene-editing technology called CRISPR, Chinese scientists say they made modifications to a fertilized egg as part of an IVF treatment, the goal being to make the baby resistant to HIV. The scientist behind this claims that healthy twin girls were born in the last few weeks as part of this process. Now, he's facing widespread condemnation, and ethical questions are being raised about employing this type of technology in humans. We'll be joined by Antonio Regalado from the MIT Technology Review, who broke the story this past Sunday, to help explain the situation and what we can expect from human gene editing in the years to come.
And as always, we'll end with Don't Close My Tabs, some of the best things we saw on the web this week. That's all coming up on this week's If Then.
April, it's great to have you back.
Thanks for having me back. Great show last week with Alex Stamos, formerly of Facebook and at the center of so many of the controversies at the company. Super insightful. And I want to keep talking about that a little bit because the news on that beat has not slowed down. As we said in the intro, Facebook admitted to doing this kind of opposition research right before Thanksgiving.
Right. So this is the continuing fallout from that New York Times investigation of Facebook. And when it happened, Facebook initially acknowledged that they had hired Definers Public Affairs. That's the opposition research firm that employs these DC-style tactics, in Mark Zuckerberg's words. But Zuckerberg and Chief Operating Officer Sheryl Sandberg had done a lot to try to distance themselves from that work. They said they didn't know who had hired Definers. They disclaimed knowledge of the specific tactics that Definers used. And then, of course, the night before Thanksgiving, in what is commonly known in our industry as a news dump, Facebook published a blog post where their outgoing head of communications took the fall and said, yeah, actually, not only did we hire Definers, but we told them to make that anti-Semitic smear involving George Soros. We probably shouldn't have done that, but there you go.
Yeah, it's still so shocking to me that they would resort to this just because, you know, a couple of groups, and let's be clear, one of these groups, Color of Change, is a civil rights group, were criticizing Facebook while Facebook was under, like, really understandable criticism. I mean, we were criticizing Facebook. Everybody was, because they had, you know, allowed for Russian operatives to completely instrumentalize their platform in an attempt to undermine our democratic processes. You know, there's a lot of reasons to criticize Facebook. People were criticizing Facebook because they felt that racial justice activists were being unfairly removed or censored on the platform, while people who were saying, you know, hateful things against, Muslims were allowed to stay on. You know, this is really deserved criticism of the company and stuff that they should be able to deal with without resorting to this kind of, quite frankly, prejudicial anti-Semitic framing against their very valid critics. It just doesn't seem to be playing fair at all.
Right. And we also now know that at the same time, Facebook was directing Definers Public Affairs to raise the specter of Soros and the globalists. It was trying to go after other critics by calling them anti-Semitic and saying that they were anti-Semitic for criticizing Facebook and Mark Zuckerberg and Sheryl Sandberg, really just using some of the same kind of propaganda tactics that have infected the platform, ironically. I mean, this is the stuff that they're supposed to be committed to fighting, and instead here they are paying for it to be done on their behalf to tar their critics.
And just to be clear, like for Color of Change, you know, a former Facebook employee, Dustin Moskovitz, who co-founded Facebook with Zuckerberg, not just an employee, is a much bigger supporter of the organization. He gave them $1.5 million. So, I mean, it's just very, very weaselly here. And it just makes me incredibly uncomfortable with how this company decides to wield its power. And it also makes me uncomfortable because this company is a company that we trust with so much personal information. And if they're willing to, you know, throw daggers in this way, in a way that perpetuates hate, then it doesn't make me feel comfortable that they are actually serious about eradicating hate on the platform, nor does it make me feel comfortable about what they're going to do with our data, you know, and what they're going to do with their users who trust them with all this information that can be absolutely used against them.
Yeah, so Facebook is now doing damage control on this latest self-created crisis, and they're going to meet with Color of Change, apparently, and they're going to undertake a civil rights audit this spring, studying the platform's impact on communities of color. It's interesting that it took this for them to dig into that question. But I think the big upshot here is that for a long time, critics have seen Facebook as evil and Machiavellian, and now that's starting to become a more general sentiment, I think. And even in Silicon Valley, people are turning against Facebook, and Facebook's own workers, I think, are upset.
You know, it is interesting that Facebook employees have largely been more quiet than other tech workers when it comes to criticizing their company. You know, we've seen a lot of actions from Googlers, actions from people that work at Amazon and Microsoft, but we haven't seen the same kind of response from internal Facebook employees. And that might be changing now. In fact, you know, it is changing.
Yeah, I think that might be coming. And we've talked a fair amount on this show about how Silicon Valley tech workers are one of the biggest levers of potential change or reform in the tech industry. We've just continued to see that lately. April, you linked in our company Slack earlier today to a petition going around in New York among tech workers asking them to pledge not to work for Amazon if they move to their new HQ2 in Queens, right?
Yeah, I mean, because Amazon is really being propped up as a company that does not respect the labor of its workforce. And maybe it pays well to the tech employees, but we know that if you deliver for Amazon, if you work in their warehouses, that those conditions are treacherous and that people have been so extremely disrespected when it comes to the logistics industry of online retail that, that you know, tech workers are kind of taking a stand that they don't want to be a part of that. We've also, of course, seen backlash against Amazon's recognition software, which is its facial recognition program that they have been openly selling to law enforcement, which could be used to perpetuate racist policing. Today, we saw a new petition from Googlers demanding that the company that they work for pull out of Dragonfly, which is, you know, the project to build the search engine in China. We've talked about this on our show, saying that it would kind of, you know, aid in human rights abuses there. And the interesting thing about this is that, you know, it's hundreds of Googlers have signed on, but they've done so with their full name this time, right? Like, we know that there were thousands of people who signed something earlier this year against Dragonfly at Google, but that was kept internally. Now we see people going public with their name against the company, really willing to take a stand. And what's so interesting here and so important here with kind of these tech workers fighting back is that the whole reason why these companies are valuable is because their workers are productive, because their workers build these products that people use. And as more stuff has come out that, like, you know, Google pays off sexual predators at the company to leave, you know, this is like coming from, like, with the Andy Rubin story, this is coming from money that their employees are making for the company. And so I just want to stress that this isn't just like standing on the side of a sidewalk holding a sign in front of the building. These are workers that have the power to disrupt the productivity of these companies that are powerful precisely because of their labor.
And we're seeing real responses, right? I mean, Amazon announced in October that it's raising the minimum wage to $15 for its U.S. employees. Google responded to the employee walkout by ending arbitration in sexual harassment cases. And maybe in some cases, I mean, these companies are so visible and the workers do have such leverage, maybe they're able to win some concessions here that benefit people outside the tech industry as well. There was a column in Slate yesterday by Luke Norris saying that Google employees are leading the way on sexual harassment reform. The rest of the country should follow, and that workers around the company should around the country should demand the same from their own employers.
Right. I want to talk about though where Google is not making strides, and so like the arbitration issue that you brought up, it's really great, but it doesn't count for discrimination cases at the company. It counts for kind of sexual harassment cases, and you know similarly with Facebook, there was a post today that was published by someone who used to work at Facebook, Mark Leckie, entitled "Facebook is Failing Its Black Employees and Its Black Users," and it brought up all the kind of structural ways within the company that that racism is such like an insidious force and kind of continues to perpetuate and into its products and the way that the social media site is used by Black people. And one thing that I just find really interesting is when Silicon Valley is quick to address, you know, certain issues of injustice and not others. So, you know, we see when I go to like Pride and I see all these Google shirts and all these Facebook shirts and all these people repping these companies, it's like I know that Silicon Valley is really, really good when it comes to discrimination around sexual orientation. But I know that they're not good when it comes to racial discrimination, right? So we didn't see Silicon Valley quickly take up arms when it came to the Black Lives Matter movement. But when there was the military transgender ban, which don't get me wrong, is horrible, you know, leaders spoke out immediately. And so, you know, we see companies really slow to drag their feet on some issues, perhaps because it would kind of show that these companies really only have 1 or 2% Black technical staff or and in leadership, and would kind of point to kind of the abysmal state of racial justice within these companies.
Right. So, I mean, that raises an interesting point, which is that as tech workers become this powerful force for reform in their companies, we may also have to start scrutinizing what tech workers' priorities are and what their agenda is, because that's driven in part by who they are and where they come from. And if you do not have racial diversity in the tech workforce, then you're not going to see that prioritized as much as maybe some of the other concerns.
Yeah, you know, even when these companies hire women of color, they don't stay for very long. They have a very high rate of attrition. One quote that I want to point out from this post from Mark Leckie that I mentioned before, he says, "In some buildings, there are more Black Lives Matter posters than there are actual Black people." He says this about Facebook. So really, there's just not diversity within the company. And yeah, I look forward to seeing how employees there start to mobilize around some of the issues that have been brought up in the news for so long and that are now starting to be brought up by former employees there.
All right, we're going to leave it there and take a quick break. When we come back, we'll have our interview with Antonio Regalado about CRISPR gene editing technology and the babies that were reportedly born in China with edited genes.
Apple Card is the perfect cashback rewards credit card. You earn up to 3% daily cash on every purchase every day. That's 3% on your favorite products at Apple, 2% on all other Apple Card with Apple Pay purchases, and 1% on anything you buy with your titanium Apple Card or virtual card number. Visit apple.co/card calculator to see how much you can earn. Apple Card issued by Goldman Sachs Bank, USA, Salt Lake City branch. Subject to credit approval. Terms apply.
Our guest today is Antonio Regalado, a senior editor at the MIT Technology Review. His reporting focuses on how technology is changing medicine and biomedical research. Before joining the Technology Review in 2011, he covered science, tech, and politics in Latin America for Science. He also worked at the Wall Street Journal before that. And more recently, he broke the story this past Sunday about the Chinese scientists using CRISPR gene editing technology to produce human genomes that would be resistant to HIV. The main researcher, He Jiang Kui of the Southern University of Science and Technology in Shenzhen, edited the genes of embryos used in IVF treatment. This has resulted in the live birth of two twin girls in China this month, according to the Associated Press. Since the story broke, Regalado has also reported that the scientist is now under investigation as to whether he broke any Chinese laws while conducting the controversial and secret procedure. Antonio Regalado, thank you so much for joining us.
Hey, great to be here.
So I want to start with a question that may be kind of remedial or basic, but I was telling my brother that I was going to do this podcast on this topic today, and he thought CRISPR was a company. And, you know, I just realized that a lot of people don't really understand what CRISPR is or what we mean when we say gene editing technology. Can you kind of, first of all, kind of break down with some definitions of what we're talking about here?
Sure. First of all, gene editing is just kind of a newfangled word for genetic engineering. It's a new form of genetic engineering. CRISPR, it just happens to be the cheapest, easiest, kind of most effective tool for doing it. And it was discovered sort of over a process of years, but especially starting in mid-2012, in the genome of bacteria. It's something that bacteria have to basically chop up incoming viruses. They have a way to kind of remember what these viruses look like, and as soon as the virus gets into the bacteria has this special protein called Cas9. It's called a nuclease, and that this special protein is basically like a big pair of scissors that goes and chops up the viruses. And so what happened in 2012 into 2013 is that scientists basically managed to get this system out of the bacteria so you could use it in other types of cells, plant cells, pig cells, cattle cells, and human cells to change the DNA really easily in those types of cells. So it's just a phenomenally easier to use technology for genetic engineering, and it's just taken off, I mean, in so many directions.
And including the direction that it's been kind of tested for potential use in humans, or now that we know actual use in human embryos. Can you tell us what happened with JK, as he's called? The doctor from Shenzhen?
Right. Just backing up to 2015, you know, I mentioned these animals. So
right.
As soon as CRISPR came out, people were in a big race. You know, I got to edit the goat, and I have to edit the sheep, and I got to edit the zebrafish. And they were just running through this list of species. And just at the end of 2013, I think it was January 2014, someone edited a monkey, right? They produced monkeys that whose genomes had been altered by CRISPR. And so a lot of people, including myself, kind of had the thought, well, gee, you could edit a monkey, you probably could edit a human. And it wasn't long, I think in March 2015, where we heard the first report of someone editing a human embryo. And why would you do that? In that case, they had edited it to remove the RIS gene for beta thalassemia, which is a blood disease actually common in South China, where the research was carried out. So suddenly you had people editing these human embryos in an IVF clinic. So clearly it kind of raised the next possibility. Was like, well, would you take that embryo and implant it into a woman's uterus and produce the live birth? And so there have been just a ton of meetings, high-level discussions, and a lot of hand-wringing and anxiety about this next step, which is, you know, genetically engineer the human species, basically. A lot of people didn't want to see it happen yet. It might not be safe. A bunch of other people think that it's kind of a line in the sand that shouldn't be crossed. We really shouldn't take that step. And what happened was in China, a researcher that most people had never heard of took the step in secrecy and apparently, allegedly, produced two girls whose genomes had been changed to remove a gene called CCR5, and we can talk about what that is and how it's connected to HIV. The doctor, who calls himself JK, I'm just going to call him that as well. It's a kind of a nickname that he uses. He says that he's produced twin girls. There's twin girls who've been edited, so they've actually been born. Of course, the scientists are very upset because there's no paper, there's no data to look at. Nobody really knows if it's true. Some people have seen a paper because there's a paper in circulation. He's trying to get it published. Good luck with that. And that's where things stand. Yep.
And so I just want to step back. The early testing on animals, that was to eradicate disease?
No, actually, more often to introduce disease, because you want an animal model that suffers from some human disease, right? You'd like to see a monkey that has, I don't know, autism, or you know, a pig that has some kind of heart disease. You're trying to introduce human diseases into animals. Or you're trying to make animals that are kind of interesting or more useful, right? You could get a cow that's bigger and that has more meat on it, or I think there was one in China where they'd tweak things with CRISPR so that the hair of the goats, sort of cashmere goats or something, would be a lot longer and you could collect it. There was another one, pretty interesting case, where some scientists in the U.S. had figured out what was the formula to give cows horns or not have horns. And so they introduced sort of the no-horn recipe into Holsteins, dairy cows.
Oh, my gosh.
Who normally do have horns. Yeah. And the horn caused problems. If you work on a dairy farm 364 days a year, you can take a school bus full of children there. But there's one day when you can't, and that's dehorning day. It's this huge bloody mess with chemicals and acids, and they take the horns off the cows. So here was a kind of a genetic solution. Well, you could just make a cow with no horns. And that's what they did.
All right. And so when we talk about editing human genes, people might start to think about making smarter babies, faster, stronger babies, creating some kind of master race. But that's a ways off, right?
I don't know how far off it is. This gene that he chose is kind of in a gray zone. It's in a gray zone between medicine and enhancement. So we could just walk through kind of what those zones are. First, medicine. You could imagine a situation where maybe you have Huntington's disease, which is a fatal disease. It's terrible. It's due to a sort of genetic change that some people have. And, you know, imagine you wanted to have children that didn't have the Huntington's gene. In this case, half your children on average would also have Huntington's if you do. So what you might do is you might go to an IVF clinic and with your partner and have the embryos made. And then you could do one of two things. First of all, you could genetically test them, and you could just choose the embryos that didn't have the Huntington's gene. And so that's actually what people do today, or can do. So that's called selection, and that's kind of one way to do it. The idea with genome editing is that you might also be able to go into those embryos with CRISPR and just sort of delete the problematic gene. So this raises the question, well, why would you do it? Why would you do the CRISPR, which might have unknown risks, when you can already just choose the unaffected embryo? And that is an important question, because it really reduces the need for this whole idea of editing the embryos at all. I mean, a lot of people say there's no need for it. On the other hand, IVF doesn't work that well. It's difficult. You don't always get a pregnancy. So the IVF doctors say, yes, but we want as many embryos as we can. So we'd like to fix the bad ones and then try and use them all to create the birth. But the scenario that I gave you there, that's medicine. The embryo literally has something wrong with it, a genetic defect, and you're trying to repair it. So that's one of the concepts. Enhancement, on the other extreme, is, you know, what could you do something to the embryo to increase its intelligence? Could you change its hair color? Could you change its height? Some of these enhancement things might actually be possible today. Others are still sort of science fiction, just because people kind of don't know what the genes are that you would change to make the baby more intelligent, but it's kind of the direction that things are leading. So JK chose a case that is problematic because it's kind of in between medicine and enhancement. He's taking a totally normal embryo, and he's using CRISPR to mutate it, right? Which itself is kind of questionable. And the change that he wants to remove this gene CCR5 and render the children immune to HIV. So HIV is not a disease that these embryos have. It's not even a disease that the children have. It's a disease that they could have in the future. So it's more like a vaccine. And I think that's the word he's used to describe it. It's kind of a genetic vaccine against a future disease. So it isn't a form of enhancement. In the same way that a vaccine that protects you against chickenpox is kind of an enhancement of your immune system, so too this embryo editing, in this case, would protect you against HIV. So it's a very strange choice to have made for the first CRISPR baby, but I think it was made just because, for technical reasons, it was one of the easier things to do. Yeah.
Yeah, you've been talking about this line between medicine and enhancement, and I guess that matters because our society has chosen to draw that line, right? Like, we're okay with people taking stimulant medications if they have ADHD. we're not okay, because that's medicine, we're not okay with them taking it if they don't have ADHD just to get an edge on their exam or something like that.
Yeah, but we do it anyway, right? So in this debate over the edited embryos and now the edited people, it has been this game of sort of drawing lines in the sand and then crossing them. You know, the original line in the sand was, you know, never interfere with the human genome, that it's somehow sacrosanct. Well, we crossed that line. And then more recently, sort of the experts have said, well, you know, the medical uses of this technology might be reasonable. If it could be done safely, carefully regulated, we could do it for medicine, but we'll never do enhancement because that's wrong. But then even more recently, there's another ethics body in the UK that said, well, you know what? I'm not sure we can really draw that line. I think enhancement would be okay too, so long as everybody gets it, so long it's that it's socially equitable. So we keep advancing where this line is. And in effect, there is no line.
Yeah, I don't see how enhancement could ever be socially equitable because we don't, as healthcare isn't socially equitable yet, right? And so it seems like there's just an inevitability for extreme stratification for the access to this type of, you know, genetic pre-birth enhancement.
Yeah, but of course, you know, the practice of medicine has its own standards. And so there's already a lot of things that you could do in an IVF clinic that people don't really do, like sex selection. Could you choose the gender of the embryo? It's really easy to do. In China, it's banned. I mean, we think of China as this Wild West, but they actually prohibit the choosing of the sex of the embryo. In the U.S., it's allowed, but kind of discouraged. If you're testing the embryo anyway, well, maybe they'll tell you, but they wouldn't test the embryo, you know, just to tell you the gender of it. So in the U.S., it's kind of a mixed system. You can find out, but not always. So the standards that doctors hold up and sort of, you know, societal agreements do make a big difference in how these technologies get used. And honestly, it's also just what is practical, right? I don't think you're going to go to the clinic and get a CRISPR baby for yourself unless there's a really, really good reason. I don't think this JK guy in China has come up with a good reason, but even so, you know, IVF is a big pain. The eggs have to be collected. It's like a whole month process of shots. It costs a lot of money. You know, it's a lot easier to do it the old-fashioned way.
So that brings me to a final question. You know, how difficult is this process at this point, and how soon do you think it is till we see this, you know, potentially more widespread or available to people?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, the basic problem is that it's not that hard to do. That's why people were talking about it even before it happened,
Wow. Kind
of predicting it would happen. It's just not that hard to do. That's how easy this CRISPR technology is. It's really effective. It could be hard to do well. Obviously, not everybody has you know, an embryology lab at their disposal, but it's definitely relatively easy to do. The technology is pretty precise. So that's the whole problem. It is doable. How soon? I think depends on these other factors. Sort of how much grit people put kind of in the wheels of this machine to slow it down. What people want. What's on offer at the IVF clinics. I don't really think it will happen all that fast. I think a more realistic outcome is that it would be pretty narrowly used in cases of severe genetic diseases that you want to avoid passing on.
Right. So, and just a quick point of clarification. I mean, you're saying it is easy to use this technology to edit a gene. It doesn't necessarily mean it's easy to alter a human in more abstract ways, like making them smarter. I mean, there are all kinds of ways that could backfire. There's not one specific gene that makes you smart.
Right. In the case of intelligence, I mean, there's plenty of one specific gene to make you less intelligent. I mean, there's all kinds of disorders, you know, mental disorders. I don't think that they know of, you know, particular genes that are going to make you a lot more intelligent, but the way genetics is going, they are gradually zeroing in on what are some of the genes and genetic locations associated with higher intelligence. They are. So it could in the future come together with CRISPR, but the problem is just you'd have to sort of change the genome at many locations, which today is not feasible, but tomorrow it might be.
You know, we think of birth as a starting point, even though people select their mates and you know, all of this stuff happens before birth. So this is really kind of a a new way of thinking about evolution in many ways. If we think about editing the genome, it's just so wild, and it brings up so many questions. But I guess I'm curious now, finally, even though I said finally before, what is the legal scaffolding around this at this point? Is there any actual rules against this internationally or nationally? You said that in China there's, you know, some banning on picking the sex, and in the U.S. it's more gray, but is there anything preventing this besides the medical community shunning it?
In the U.S., it would be illegal right now to take one of these edited embryos and actually try and establish a pregnancy. The Congress, I think sort of Republican pro-life elements of the Congress, managed to get a rider in a funding bill for the FDA where they have told the FDA you cannot even accept or consider an application from anybody to do this. So in the U.S. currently, and because, you know, the FDA does regulate that area, in the U.S. it would be illegal to transfer one of these edited embryos. In China, it's a little bit harder to tell, as are a lot of things in China. There is a rule on the books from 2003 that basically says the same thing. Don't transfer the embryo. But it's kind of unclear if that's a guidance or a law or what that is. So it's a little less clear in China. In many parts of Europe, the whole thing would be completely banned. UK has a kind of sophisticated way to regulate these technologies, so it would be illegal there unless they gave permission, which they could do. So, you know, there's various regulatory regimes whereby it could happen, but for the most part, it's actually banned. And so one of the questions with JK, the scientist in China, is whether, you know, did he commit a crime? Did he break the rules or not? And it's not clear. A lot of people are investigating him right now, I can tell you that. And you mentioned evolution, and I thought that was pretty interesting because if you think about it, like you, April, Will, myself, we're the products of evolution, the products of millions of years of evolution. But now, as we take it into our own hands, as we start to edit the genomes of the embryos, like we're changing evolution, right? So it is just a really strange outcome. Or maybe it's an outcome that makes a lot of sense. It's kind of like the snake bites its own tail. Evolution has created the species that can control evolution, right? And maybe speed it up.
Yeah, this is just so much to think about. And I'm really excited to continue to follow your excellent reporting on this. Antonio, thank you so much for joining us.
Great to be here. Thanks.
One final quick break and then don't close my tabs. Some of the best things we've seen on the web this week.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Hey, listeners, whether you love true crime or comedies, celebrity interviews, news, or even motivational speakers, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue, right? And guess what? Now you can call the shots on your auto insurance, too. Enter the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. The Name Your Price tool puts you in charge of your auto insurance by working just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance. Then they'll show you a variety of coverages that fit within your budget, giving you options. Now, that's something you'll want to press play on. It's easy to start a quote, and you'll be able to choose the best option for you fast. It's just one of the many ways you can save with Progressive Insurance. Quote today at progressive.com to try the Name Your Price tool for yourself and join over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Tabs time. Will, what's open on your browser right now?
All right. My tab this week is a little old. It's from a week or so ago in The New Yorker, but it's so fascinating. And it actually might take you a while to read. It's called The Mystery of the Havana Syndrome. It's about the unexplained brain injuries that have afflicted American diplomats abroad. It started in Cuba. The story is just this really compelling and disorienting mystery about a mysterious ailment that has been called at various times sonic attacks or mysterious brain injuries. It's been referred to as a concussion without a concussion. Some of the people who were suffering from it just called it the thing because there's no real diagnosis from it. Nobody knows exactly what happened, but the New Yorker does its best to get to the bottom of it. It's really just a gripping story. And it resonated with me especially because mysteries are just kind of rare in modern life, or they seem kind of rare. Like things that we just can't figure out or just don't know what's happening don't feel like they come around that often anymore. This is one, and it's just it's worth your time.
I really want to read it. I've been following these bizarre sonic terrorism or whatever I want to think of it stories for a few years now, and I look forward to a long read kind of explaining this question mark that I've had in my mind for so long every time these headlines come up. For my story this week, I am not done reading it. I have to be totally honest, but I'm very excited to finish reading it. It is called A Business with No End. It's a feature in the New York Times that was actually published today while we are here recording, which is why I'm not done. It's by Jenny Odell, an artist based in Oakland. And it is about everything, it seems. You know, everything from like weird religious scammers that are selling like bizarre trash products to like it's kind of Newsweek, and which has this really wild parent company that Will has written about, a company called Adult Printed Diapers. it's just like I'm still in the middle of reading it, but it's just kind of this dizzying telling of kind of capitalism and media and this kind of like loopy story. One line in it that sticks out: I couldn't get over the idea that a church might be behind a network of used business books, hair straighteners, and suspiciously priced compression stockings on Amazon, all while running a once venerable American news publication into the ground. Talking about Newsweek there. So I'm still in the middle of reading it, but I hope that you guys read it too. And then you can feel free to email me or tweet at me about your thoughts, because I think I'm going to want to process this. I'm already really captivated. But yeah, it's about SEO creepiness and kids videos. You know, Scientology makes a cameo in here. So definitely a rich story that hopefully will give us some useful understanding on this kind of bizarre internet economy that we're all so dependent on and yet barely understand. And just to be clear, I don't know if this is a good tab because I'm not done reading it, but I really look forward to. But it's called A Business with No End, subtitle, Where Does This Strange Empire Start or Stop? And so it's actually a piece in 10 parts. So epic for sure. Can't wait to finish.
Yeah, there's a lot I could say about it, but I think you're better off just reading it because it's too weird and complicated to get into here. I guess that's true of both of our tabs this week.
I just am really excited for weird, complicated writing that helps us understand the world that we unwittingly live and survive in better, and hopefully bring us to a higher place after we're done with it. And that seems like this what this is going to do. So I'm excited to finish.
Yeah, and it is because nobody understands some of these dark internet arts that a company like this has been able to exist. I mean, it's the fact that this stuff is obscure that allows them to pull off the fraud.
Oh my gosh, so much reading. I love reading when it's chilly outside, but that does it for this week. You can get updates about what's coming up next by following us on Twitter at IfThenPod.
You can also email us at ifthen@slate.com. Send us your tech questions, show and guest suggestions, or just say hi.
You can follow me and Will on Twitter as well. I'm at April Laser, and Will is at Will Remus.
Thanks again to our guest, Antonio Regalado. You can find him on Twitter at Antonio Regalado. That's Antonio Regalado.
And thanks to everyone who's left us a comment or review on Apple Podcasts or whatever platform you use to listen. We appreciate you taking the time to do that. I know it's kind of an awkward thing, so thanks.
If Then is a production of Slate and Future Tense, a partnership between Slate, Arizona State University, and New America. Our producer is Max Jacobs.
Thanks to Alberto Hernandez for engineering here in Berkeley, California.
Thanks to Nick Holmes at Occupy Studios in Newark, Delaware. We'll see you next week.
Bye, y'all.